And also each Enneagram type has this sort of like burning fire inside. You can't stay down for long if you just give it space. Mm-hmm. You know, so like the 8 has this stubbornness that can get them back up. The 1 has this sense of purpose. The 2 has just this selfless love. They just want to get back up and help more people, right? So being able to identify that helps us in those moments trust that it's going to be there.
Welcome to the Wish I'd Known Then podcast, where we focus on how authors found success, looking at strategies that have taken them to the top of the bestseller charts, as well as what they've learned from their mistakes. Because being an indie author is more than knowing the latest marketing trend. It's about being innovative and creative and learning from your mistakes.
Welcome to Wish I'd Known Then podcast. I'm Sarah Rosette.
And I'm Jamie Albright. And this week on the show, we have
Claire Taylor.
Yes, we do. She's a returning guest, but she's here to talk about her new book that she's got running on a Kickstarter called Author Sustainability.
Yeah, it's called Sustain Your Author Career, and yeah, talking about how to be a writer long term, having mm-hmm. taken the long term view. Mm-hmm. Claire's just so good at looking at a situation and assessing things and figuring out how to help authors work in a way that is healthier, basically, mm-hmm. so we don't kill ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she really is. She and Becca really are two of the most prominent voices on that. And they both make such good sense when you really stop and listen to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, she gave us some really good tips. We talked about mistakes that she sees authors making about mm-hmm. sustainability, common blocks that authors have. And we talked about the Enneagram a lot. She uses mm-hmm. that to help people. It helps you see kind of what you're doing and where your issues are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a really good chat.
It was a great chat. But we have 2 new supporters.
We do. Yes. We have 2 new supporters. So thank you to Terry Thomas, who chose the dog emoji.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica chose the fire emoji. So thanks, guys. We appreciate it.
Yes, we do. So if you want to support the podcast, you can go to wishidknownforwriters.com/support. And, you know, we're so excited to see new supporters and all the supporters that we do have. Mm-hmm. Come and join us in the Slack if you're a new supporter. Yeah. And we will just keep doing episodes, exclusive episodes, and chatting with you guys and bringing you stuff that's helpful, we hope.
Right. Well, what's been going on with you?
More writing mm-hmm. and getting some things marked off my list that are like task things that had to be done. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're not super exciting. Did listen to the 2 podcasts this week that I was going to recommend. Both of them, Joanna Penn interviewed Becca Syme and Claire mm-hmm. Taylor. So if you want more about the Enneagram, go mm-hmm. listen to the Creative Pen podcast. So those were both really good. So I decided to move my books from Findaway Voices to Authors Republic. And I've found out a couple of things about that I just thought I would share that might be helpful to other people. Mm-hmm. I didn't really want to leave Findaway because I really like the people there. They've been really good to me and they're always very helpful and supportive, but I just am not happy with what Spotify has done in the past. And I don't want to be in a situation where things don't work out well.
Right.
So I'm going to go ahead and move to Authors Republic. Mm-hmm. And so I've got my books loaded up. I've requested that they be taken down from Findaway, and it takes about 30 days for those to come down off mm-hmm. all the other platforms. So if you do want to move, then you need to pull those books down, and Authors Republic doesn't want you to distribute anything until the books are down on the other retailers so that there's not duplicates.
Right.
And I talked to Findaway about it, and they said, leave your Findaway account open. Don't mm-hmm. close it, because then you can still email them if you have questions, and you can, you know, check on your payments, because the payments come in after.
Later. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A month or two mm-hmm. later. So they said, you know, just email us and let us know and unpublish your books and then wait for them to transfer over. So it's kind of a process, but it really hasn't been that bad.
That's good.
I will be glad when the transition is done. So hopefully mm-hmm. that helps people if they're thinking about, you know, making a change.
Right.
So I'll give you an update later on how it went.
Good. Good.
Yeah. So that's what I've been doing. What about you?
Writing, working on covers for the Bride series. I think we're finalizing the second one when I get off this call. They're super cute. And I'm working on new blurbs. So, you know, I go from doing nothing to a lot of things all at one time, it feels like. But, you know, there's still so much that I probably could be doing. But those are the only things I feel like I really have the mental capacity for right now. And the writing's good. You know, one of the things that was super hard, even before I stopped writing before, you know, even before Joni got really sick, was that when I would get up from the computer and do something else, there would, like, the story would just leave my head. Like, I didn't think about the story. I didn't mull over the story. New ideas didn't really come. It just seemed really, difficult. And it's still hard to write. I mean, I'm doing, I saw this thing on TikTok that said, you know, because all the information now in my entire life comes from TikTok. but it was this guy getting into this ice bath, and he was just, it was like a narration, but it basically said, do one hard thing a day. Like, just do one hard thing a day. And briefly, I considered getting an ice bath. And
I was
going
to say, it's not going to be an ice bath for me.
Oh, me either. And because I'm very easily influenced, but the hard thing for me is writing. I mean, it's just the writing. So it's always hard for me, but it was harder because every time I sat down at the computer, I was just like, it was like I was starting from zero almost. And over the last couple of weeks, new ideas have just come into my head. I'll be laying in bed and I think about something, or I'll be doing, you know, walking and I think of an idea. And that's so exciting because that hasn't happened in a very long time. So I'm really pleased about that. And that's awesome. Really it for me.
That is awesome. Yeah. I think like once you get back into it, those ideas start coming and it just takes a while to get into it. And you don't have to be immersed in it. Well, I do. I feel like I need to kind of be in the story and thinking about it. It takes a while to get to that point.
Right. And you know, what I have learned over the years of publishing and writing and stop, you know, and taking a break and then writing more and taking a break is that I do better when I stay in the story. Even if I don't know what's happening, I do better if I stay in the story. And so, you know, where some people can walk away and like high-end election people, you know, sit and think about it. I do need time to mull things over, but I don't need weeks, which I have taken before because I panic. But that's what's happened. And I'm feeling good about it. I'm trying to be low key, you know, and not talk about it a ton, but,
that's awesome. Yeah. Well, I have a entertainment recommendation.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah.
So of course it's a K-drama. It's mystery cop show called Flex Cop. It's Flex with two X's.
Okay.
Flex X Cop. It's on Hulu. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me a lot of like The Mentalist or Castle. It's got a lot of humor. It's an odd couple pairing. He is grumpy. I'm sorry, she's grumpy. The detective is a female and she's grumpy. And she's paired up with this rich man who kind of like Castle was like wanting to be involved in police investigation. And he's Sunshine. Mm-hmm. And it's just, they have good mysteries. I mean, it's been very, very subtle, slow burn romance, I think. Mm-hmm. We're getting near the end. There's like two episodes left.
Right.
So I think there's going to be a little more romance. I'm not sure. So, but it's really good. It's
on Hulu. Very good. Very good. Well, we should probably get on with the interview because Claire has got great things to talk about.
Yes. Yeah, so here is Claire.
All right.
Today, we are happy to have Claire Taylor with us. Hi, Claire. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Welcome back.
Yes, we're excited to talk to you again. Yep. So let me read your bio and we'll get right to the questions.
Claire is a humor and mystery author and the owner of FFS Media. She uses her training in the Enneagram framework of core motivation to help authors build unforgettable stories and resilient careers that thrive through the ups and downs of the publishing industry. And don't we all need that? So. Thank you for being here. Give us a quick update on what's happened since you were last on the podcast.
Well, since I've last been on, man, that was a couple years ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
I have created a new brand. So I now have the Liberated Writer brand, mm-hmm. which is more geared towards helping authors do that deep work that is required for sustainability and for, you know, confronting the fears that they have. A lot of it is just looking directly at the fears and deconstructing them a little bit so that, you know, you have more options. So that's what I'm really trying to help people with for publishing right now is, you know, things change a lot and the things that were working, the tactics that were working for authors a year ago have stopped working. And so it feels like things are narrowing. Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy when you're like, okay, I have this set amount of things I can try and I've gone through all of them. Now I'm out of options. Mm-hmm. And you're not out of options, right? We can work to look to broaden that sort of range of what we can see as we work through fear. Because there's a lot of options if we just accept that they're kind of scary to us, but we can do that. We can do that. So okay. Yeah, so it's about, I promise we can do it with enough support. And so it's really about helping people find new options because so much is changing right now. And so I've been doing that with my 5-week Liberated Writer course and my Liberated Writer retreat that I do, mm-hmm. you know, yearly. So that's a big thing that I've launched. And then I have my new book, Sustain Your Author Career, coming out. And that is in line with the Liberated Writer brand. It's about, mm-hmm. you know, sort of assessing where we're getting blocked. Because sometimes, you know, sometimes you're writing a story and you get stuck and it's, yeah, you have a story issue to figure out, but sometimes you have an author issue to figure out. And so that's really like, we can brainstorm the story stuff. And I do still do that with people, but sometimes we need to brainstorm the author stuff and figure out like, what is keeping you from being able to focus, being able to see the next step, being able to just sit down and write. So yeah, that's really been the biggest shift lately.
And I will say that with your Liberated Author courses and retreats, you have created some evangelical followers. We joke with Claire a lot, not Sarah and I, but some other friends and I, that Claire could start a cult. And she's maybe on her way to doing that. My dog.
That sounds like so much responsibility that I don't want.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Well, so your new book is about sustainability and resilience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes. And almost everything you do has some component of the Enneagram in it. So tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that and how you're incorporating that into helping authors.
Right. So the Enneagram framework is based off of core motivations, and those core motivations break down into a fear and a desire. And those fear and desire, they're two sides of the same coin, really. So you may have the fear of being worthless, and your desire is to have worth or value, right? So those motivations are what define each type, what your core motivation is. You may have a lot of the fears, but there's going to be one that you're going to avoid above all. And that is where your type is. So then there are these patterns of attention that arise from that fear, because our attention goes towards protecting us from the fear first and foremost. And so those patterns of attention lead to thinking, feeling, and behaving, sets of thinking, feeling, and behaving that we tend to limit ourselves to, get very stuck in. And so that's what the Enneagram shows us. It helps us look into our head, into our heart, into our body, or sometimes called the gut center, and really say what's going on here. And then we can take those beliefs, we can start to notice our patterns. And just when we notice them, then we're able to pause and sort of hold them up and inspect them and go, where did I learn this? Does this actually have any truth? Or is this just, you know, a piece of this armor that I'm wearing that's very limiting, right? And so we want to get rid of some of the old armor that's keeping us from being able to move. Because the number one thing we need as authors to stay in the game is flexibility. And that's emotional and mental flexibility. So we can continue to have options. So that's what the Enneagram does. There's 9 types. Each person is one type. They have a dominant type. Then there's a lot of movement within the Enneagram. We can look a little bit like one of the numbers on either side of us, or we, under stress, we'll start to take on some patterns of a different type. It's called our stress type. And as we become sort of unburdened by some of the restrictive patterns of our type, we start to look like another type, which is our growth type. And we start to have these really healthy qualities of it and unlock these sort of new options for ourselves. So that is what the Enneagram does. It's, you know, it's based in psychology. It's sort of a collective project of a bunch of much smarter people than me. So I just get to, you know, learn about it. And what it does is it helps us learn about our motivation, what's motivating us. And so you can see why that's really helpful for writing characters, right? And it's really helpful for understanding why we've been doing the things we've been doing in our business, so that when they stop working, we can let them go and try something else.
That's really great. I've used it for characters.
Yeah.
I used it for myself, not as successfully as with characters. It's always easier with us.
It is. They take our advice, you know?
Exactly.
You can steer them where you want them to go. Yeah. It's much easier than ourselves. No, I was going to say that I feel like the work that Beck has done with the Strengths for Writers and the Enneagram, they're both very helpful for the writer community, because it gives us ways to talk about things that we maybe didn't know how to or didn't have a vocabulary for. And I love using the Enneagram for characters, because it really drills down to that desire, and I think it's,
and their fear, and
yeah, you know, it just is very helpful for characters. And then as we're able to apply it to ourselves, I think it does help us, helps me see things. I'm like, oh, that's why I do that. It helps me pinpoint certain behaviors that maybe are not as healthy, or I could work here. So I'm interested in it.
And we're not ever trained very effectively on what is a healthy versus an unhealthy thought, or what is a healthy versus an unhealthy expression of emotion, or, you know, all these beliefs. There's no formal education for it. So we can really end up with some unhealthy things lodged in our brains and in our hearts. And so I think that what can be really helpful is that the Enneagram for each type has this range of behaviors, these 9 levels of development. And it describes, like, this is what a healthy expression looks like. This is what an average expression looks like. And most of us are in those average levels most of the time. And this is what it is to be unhealthy. And it's really interesting when you start to look through this, how many unhealthy levels are prized and valued in certain areas of life. And that can really start to put the puzzle pieces together for why things that we may have been trying, thinking that they were effective and healthy and the right way to do things, are causing a lot of problems for us.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I just think back on myself. I was called very sensitive like my whole life. So I'm really sensitive when it comes to people saying that about me. So with my girls in particular, you know, when they would get upset or they would think something that just simply wasn't true, I would say, your feelings will lie to you, which I thought I was helping them. And to some degree I was, but not really, because I didn't go that next step in saying, this is the truth. I just assumed that once I told them that their feelings were lying to them, they would figure out the truth or just know the truth. And that is not true. And we have to, like, I think the Enneagram helps you see what the truth is about you and who you are, and not just like those, you know, those things that are kind of at the bottom, you know, or
yeah. Yeah, we play a lot of games to convince ourselves that we are exactly correct, living in the truth, and everyone else has got it wrong or backwards. But like, I mean, what you were saying, Sarah, it's a language. So essentially mm-hmm. it's this language system that we can mm-hmm. learn to help us. Cause you know, it's very difficult to understand something if you don't have the language for it. And so mm-hmm. it helps us map that language. And, really, I think it's a great diagnostic tool to say, okay, something's going wrong. Mm-hmm. I sit down and I'm trying to write and mm-hmm. I just cannot. What is going on? How do I, you know, sort of look inside of me and see what is, what part of me is working too hard, so it's tired? What part of me have I disconnected from that's trying to say something and I'm just not listening to it? Mm-hmm. So we can learn a lot that way. Through just sort of the way that the Enneagram breaks things down for us so that we can conceptualize these things that are often hard to see about ourselves and hard to conceptualize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. So what's the most important lesson you've personally had to learn recently?
Recently, I have been spending a lot of time thinking about support. Mm. And I like being a one-woman show. I like doing things my way and doing it all myself to some extent. You know, there's sort of this idea of like, oh, I hate doing it all myself. Well, if I hated it that much, I would have not been doing it. So there's something gratifying about that for me. And recently, about a month ago, I lost my dog. And so my capacity is very low. And it was already very low from other things in life, right? And so this sort of idea of like, I thought I had pretty good support, but it turns out I didn't have enough. Mm-hmm. So something that I'm learning and in discussing this with other people, I'm realizing that like, however much support we think we need, we should double that. Because there's a part of us that, especially in a very individualistic culture and in an industry of people who are like, authors, right? One person shows for the most part. That tends to sort of select a lot of very independent people who like to be able to do things on their own and who have managed to do things on their own, oftentimes mm-hmm. with very little support. But support is this thing that I keep having to remind myself, I don't want to build it because I need it. I can just build it because I want it, mm-hmm. because it mm-hmm. just makes things easier. And that kind of goes along with the lesson that I keep having to learn of say, I won't before say, you have to say, I can't. And so for me, that's a big thing is just realizing how much support helps. I have a lot of support. I was kind of blown away by how much support I've had that I've seen show up in the last month. It's been really kind of mind-blowing and has made me feel emotions that are very uncomfortable for me.
I don't like it. Yeah.
Like, why am I just crying all of the time? I'm like over here hydrating. Yeah. But yeah, so that has been something that I've been learning a lot and, you know, something that I really want to share. And it's always been something that I like to do for people. I like to let people that I love know that like I'm there and try to anticipate how I can support them. And now it's just kind of like, oh yeah, that really is kind of what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, and it helps when you're at a point where you just feel like I don't have the capacity for this, like where I've been for the last year and a half, and have those people who support you go, yeah, and that's okay. Like, nobody's expecting you to, or yeah, you don't, because these things have happened and you are depleted. And when you have people like that just supporting you in kind of where you are, it makes a huge difference, huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that
thinking sometimes, or I do, but it, mm-hmm. it still is such a counterbalance to that, that it helps.
And when you look around the industry, it's the people who have managed to build support for themselves who have mm-hmm. stuck around. Mm-hmm. That is probably among the top three or five factors. And what right. allows someone to stay in this game is, do you have support? And some people go about it as like, I've got to build allies. And I think that might be the wrong mindset. Cause I think that there's support that, you know, it's just through genuine connection, which is what we're all going for mm-hmm. is connection. Mm-hmm. And we do it in, you know, according to the Enneagram, we tend to fear nine kinds of separation. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you can just build that, then it makes the career so much better. And it's not just in the industry, build support outside of the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, when I knew that the, you know, the heartbreak of losing Petty was coming up, I scheduled some therapy appointments, mm-hmm. you know, so mm-hmm. there's things that you can do to create support for yourself. And it makes all of the difference. I mean, I've been kind of pausing and looking around and being like, I think I'm okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I'm fine, but this is unusual for like to be in a situation that's this tumultuous and overwhelming and be like, I'm actually okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a new experience for me that I'm learning, and it's great.
Mm-hmm. That's great. It's also good to have support when you're in a situation like that, where people say, you know, yes, no one expects you to do anything, but we do believe you can when you're ready. You know, mm-hmm. and that, because I think that you're right. Those are the people that stay around, because it's easy to, it would have been so easy in the last 18 months for me to just go, you know what? Nobody's going to just send out an email to my readers. This has been fun. But having the support of friends, author friends and other friends and family there to go, no, we really think you can do this again, has helped me stay in the game. Kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, anytime you have something that's crushing, regardless of what it is, because it's relative, you just need that. You need those people.
Right. And I, you know, there's a lot of work that we do as authors that only we can do, right? Mm-hmm. The internal work, only you can do that work for yourself. Mm-hmm. But it's almost impossible to continue doing that work if you don't have support from people outside of you. So this sort of like face your fear, it's so much easier to face those fears down when you have those people who are like, listen, like if you had given up, if you had just said, I'm calling it quits, that would have been your fear talking, right? Mm-hmm. That would have,
yeah.
But you had people saying, you'll be okay. Right. Yeah. Cause sometimes we reach our capacity of what we feel like, you know, I'll be okay with. And then we have other people that are like, oh, stop it. You're going to be fine. Like, we'll sell your books for you if we have to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that is so crucial. If we're going to do this work, we have to make sure that it's not just all on us. Mm-hmm. We need mm-hmm. support too.
Yeah. Other people can sometimes see the things that you can't because you're so close to it. It takes
most of the time,
perspective. It's like we get all in our little heads and can't see
those damn trees.
I love it when people call me out and I'm like, oh, thank you. I've been trying to figure this out. Like, thank you for just telling me what I'm doing over and over again.
And I don't have to figure it out. Yeah.
Well, kind of along the same lines, this may be the same answer, but what's the biggest change you've had to make in your thinking? Would you say the support thing is that, or would it be something else?
I don't think that, I mean, maybe that's the change, but I think for me, I've had so many changes in my thinking lately. Doing this Enneagram work myself on my own career and working with other people. And I think that one of the shifts that I've seen is that I've just realized how much there is no barrier between author life and everything else in your life. It all bleeds through. And we may have some defense mechanisms like compartmentalization that can avoid that. But it bleeds through, and that's actually really good news, because your issues bleed into your author career, they bleed into your relationships, they bleed into your health and all of these different things. So you only have to go to one source to try and figure it out. And, you know, I think that sort of lack of differentiation is something I've been thinking a lot about. And, you know, I like to separate it out, but I think that, you know, I still stand by the fact that it's really good to have a life outside of writing. And that is helpful for resilience too. Cause if the worst comes to pass in your writing career, if your worst fears, you know, become real, which they usually don't, but if they did, you can just disappear. You can just go somewhere else and still be okay. But you know, there's, there's just, I think it's just really nice that we can, everything that we do in us improves every part of our life.
So you're saying you don't think of it as like that phrase about work-life balance. Do you just think of it as
all of that?
I mean, I don't know that there is such a thing as work-life balance. I think that when we connect more deeply to ourselves, we sort of can understand the rhythms of what we need. And sometimes it's working really hard and, you know, and moving things forward. And sometimes it's taking a break, and we'll always be out of balance, and we will always make mistakes and get off track. And so the tools that we're trying to develop and the skills we're trying to hone are about, how do I get back on track? How do I, you know, how do I correct
as
this
quickly
faster?
As possible. Yeah.
Faster than the last time. Yeah.
Yes. Well, speaking of
that, speaking of that, how do you view mistakes and how do you recover when things go wrong? I mean, I know you, so, but tell our listeners who don't know you.
Well, let's see. So I think that it depends on each person, mm-hmm. what that mistake, because you want to figure out what that mistake is telling you about yourself. Because mm-hmm. That's really the sore spot, is what is that threatening in like how I think about myself? How is that making me feel about myself? Because for some people, it will, you know, a mistake may make them feel exposed and vulnerable. It may make them feel foolish. It may make them feel like a bad person or like a failure. So I think that, you know, and those are all different fears of types, but you can kind of trace it back to that first, that mistake. And then, you know, that's usually like a very primal part of you that's making that connection. And I think you can kind of talk yourself through it. But also, if you make a mistake, depending on the nature of the mistake, one of the really good tools for everyone to learn is how to deliver an apology. This is also a skill we are not taught in school. There's a really good book by Harriet Lerner. I think it's called Why Won't You Apologize? It might be Why Won't They Apologize? But I think it's Why Won't You Apologize? And it's a short book, and she just walks through the four steps of how to deliver an apology. And it is so enlightening. Mm-hmm. It helps you realize why people have not been reacting well to your apologies. Mm-hmm. And it helps you understand why the apologies that you've gotten through your life felt very unfulfilling. So I think that that is a really important tool for anyone who's worried about accidentally hurting people's feelings, accidentally stepping on toes, accidentally causing harm of some kind. Mm-hmm. Knowing and having confidence that you can repair it mm-hmm. is the biggest tool for being able to risk it.
Right.
And so with mistakes and books, that sort of thing, you know, it's thankfully if you're independently published, you can change it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important to remember that however many people have read your book already, there are millions more who haven't yet read it. So there's always going to be more people in the future who will read the corrected version mm-hmm. than there are who got the, you know, the bum version. And a lot of the times you could be like, oh, that's interesting. Special edition, right?
Yeah. Collector's
so
item.
You can always flip it around. It's really low stakes for publishing. And if it feels high stakes, that's a sign that it might be time to develop some things outside of your writing life so that you can have a little bit more perspective on it. Because most of it is low stakes.
Right.
There's no emergencies in publishing, mm-hmm. you know. Unless there's a tourniquet involved, it's not an emergency.
Not like,
so,
yeah,
no,
we're not calling 911 here. Which is
yeah.
like,
right. Your ego maybe got a little bit hurt if you made a mistake, but we can work with that, right?
Yeah,
that's something we can get over and move through and learn from.
Right. Yeah. I think that's very true.
Yeah.
Well, so your new book is more about sustainability. So mm-hmm. talk to us about how the Enneagram can help with that and kind of how you are approaching that to help authors.
And this is the book you have on your Kickstarter that you're currently running, correct?
Right. And that runs through March 29th. And then it'll also have a pre-order link once it ends. But, and then of course the book will eventually be available on all retailers. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Enneagram helps us with sustainability in that it helps us with that flexibility we talked about. Mm-hmm. It helps us understand where we get our resilience from. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big part of it, because it's hard to trust that you'll be resilient if you haven't identified ways that you've already been resilient. And so that is part of the process that I talk about in this book. And also each Enneagram type has this sort of like burning fire inside, this sort of internal thing that if you just, you know, go ahead, fall on your butt, lick your wounds for a while, you can't stay down for long if you just give it space, mm-hmm. you know? So like the eight has this stubbornness that can get them back up. The one has this sense of purpose. The two has just this selfless love. They just want to get back up and help more people, right? So being able to identify that helps us in those moments trust that it's going to be there, right? So we don't have to freak out. It's going to show up. It's this gift that we have, this sort of, you know, power inside of us. So I think understanding that also, as far as sustainability, when we look at like what options have we written off too quickly, that will really narrow our pool of options. And then when that pool gets dried up, we feel like we're in deep trouble. So to sort of expand that, we can look at where we've been over-labeling. So each type does this sort of over-labeling based on this, this, you know, continuum that they think about. So the five, the investigator tends to look, function on a continuum of wise to foolish. And so they will attach labels of wise and foolish to things very subconsciously, just to narrow down the options. Because narrowing options is a really useful thing that our brain does, so we're not overwhelmed all the time, right? So we just are bringing some awareness to that function so that there may be some things that the five has written off as foolish that, you know, and that can be foolish, it can be unreasonable, irrational, those kinds of, that general area of labels, that when we go back and we really say, okay, well, hold on here. Maybe this isn't foolish. Maybe this is, maybe you could, you know, find a way to use this. And then we're getting more options there. The three may say, might write something off as saying that's a failure right there. That is a failing idea, because they're looking at the continuum of success and failure and over-labeling mm-hmm. things. And now one thing that we do is when we look on that continuum of our type, we tend to put a whole lot more toward the negative side. So we tend to write off a lot because we're very sensitive to that negative side because it's very unappealing to our ego. Mm-hmm. So the two that's looking at loving to selfish is going to over-categorize certain things as selfish, where other types would be like, I feel like feeding yourself three times a day is not selfish, right?
I was gonna say, is this like naps and like daily yes. naps, eat well, yeah. all that?
Taking care of your basic needs, yeah. if you're a two, can sometimes be labeled as selfish, right? Because we're sensitive to that if we're a two. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's another thing that I talk about. But I really also look at like, let's build our toolbox of things that can help us get through the hard times, because there will be hard times. You may be in hard times. And let's create some practices that we can do daily that give us rest on a daily basis so that we don't crash and burn.
Mm-hmm. Good, good. What are the most common mistakes authors make in regard to sustainability?
There's a big one of I'll just work really hard for a little while mm-hmm. and then I'll make all the money and then I can just sort of cruise from there.
That doesn't work.
It doesn't. Hey, I've tried it. I gave it a whirl. It's sort of like, well, yes, I'm going to work 70 hours a week on this for the next 2 months. And then it'll give it such a boost that things will just glide and then I can rest. And in sort of a similar vein, there's the mistake that people make that after they do this thing, when they hit this marker, they're going to feel a certain way about themselves. If I can just do this, 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 and this, I'll feel successful. I will feel worthy. I will feel like a good person. And they that may be that fear motivation, that fear of lacking that thing right now, may be enough for them to actually accomplish it in the short term. And then they go, oh no, I don't feel this way that I thought I would. And so that's usually a result of the fact that these feelings about ourselves have to be cultivated. They can't be earned through an achievement. They have to be cultivated daily. You know, if we want to feel like we are an independent person and, you know, look, I can do all of this on my own, and we wear ourselves out doing that, you know, we're not going to suddenly feel super independent. But if we kind of, you know, look at like, oh yeah, I am a strong person. I do have a lot of strength on a daily basis. This is really great. But also my vulnerability is part of what makes me strong, right? So we're cultivating a little bit more robust sense of that emotion along the way. A lot of people will think that they're going to feel relief, right? I'll have this sense of relief and this sense of joy when I finally sell 10,000 books, and they get there and they have not been practicing joy. They've not been cultivating it. Right. And they may feel a pop of it for a second and then it drops off. Mm-hmm. So that is what a lot of people think will happen. And then what the reality is that it doesn't work. And so then they are like, oh, I am actually like, I need to like do certain tactics and strategies that I can continue to do for a long time, because it's not just like you cross the finish line, suddenly your books sell themselves. Oh no, that's a problem because I've now worn myself out completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing is, Claire knows what she's talking about in that I've known her now for since 2016.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've seen you go through periods of, I'm going to work really hard. This was earlier, much earlier, when everybody was working really,
we were all frantic.
Yeah.
Yep.
And, but I've seen you work yourself hard, you know, work hard, but I've also seen yourself work your way through these issues with the Enneagram. I mean, you know, coming to these realizations, it's not like just something you know because you have head knowledge of it. Like, you have experience with a lot of this. And I think that that's what's really great about the classes you teach and the services you offer in this.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess it's a great thing, right? We can spin it that way. I mean, all of our
let me help you with that.
You've grown, right?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And I think that our attitudes are starting to mature as an industry. And we just need some guideposts for it. And I think the Enneagram gives a lot of really good guideposts of like, you know, is this sustainable or is this not? You know, sometimes we just don't know if this is a sustainable practice. And like with stuff like Kickstarter, I enjoy like a month long push on something. I like a quick start and a finish. That's kind of where my energy goes. Mm-hmm. I can't do that back to back like I was trying to do.
Yeah.
But there was sort of, you know, for a while, this question of like, okay, if I do this push, am I going to be like, is this the same pattern of before coming through, or is this genuinely like a wise thing to do for my energy? And so we battle with these decisions that we have to make. And so I think that, you know, I was able to look at it and say, oh no, I know how to rest now. And I'm going to schedule my calendar so that the month afterwards is very easy, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the wisdom coming in. That's not, that's like, I like a good, solid, you know, 3-4 week challenge. Mm-hmm. But then I do have to rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't just jump back into your schedule as usual kind of thing. You know?
No. Yeah. I have learned a lot of interesting things about my relationship with Google Calendar.
Well, you are in my head because I had the opportunity for something the other day and I thought, is that a wise decision? Like, is it something that, one, I want to do or feel like I have to do? And two, is it a wise decision? And I was like, that is exactly the question Claire would probably ask. I was able to answer it on my own. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I don't want people to work with me for years and years and years. I want to like help them get the skills so that they can go make those decisions and feel very confident in
Yes.
And if they want to come back for a little tune-up, we're good. It's, I'm not like, you know, don't let the door hit you. Yeah. But yeah, like that's my hope is that people just become more familiar with that pause between stimulus and response. Mm-hmm. And in that pause is where we can insert wisdom, insert self-knowledge and all of those other things.
That's great. Well, you mentioned Kickstarter. So let's talk about that for a little bit, because you've run some very successful Kickstarter campaigns in fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So what would be your tips for somebody who wants to do, maybe somebody who hasn't done a Kickstarter before, what would be your tips for somebody new to the platform?
Well, I will say do a nonfiction one because it's much easier. Okay. Fiction is so hard. Well, I mean, I probably could have done my fiction one a little bit better. I was dealing with personal stuff. There's this curse that I have with Kickstarters where like when I am about to run one or I'm trying to fulfill one or I'm running one, something happens to a dog that I own. No. So yeah. So that's, you know, that's, thankfully I have no more dogs, so I think I can run Kickstarters home free for a while. But so I would say that preparing is big. There's a lot of work on the front end.
Yeah.
The more work you do on the front end, the more success you're going to have. So it's kind of like if anyone has done any filmmaking, I did a lot of that in like high school, college, that sort of thing. The more pre-production you have, the smoother the production's going to go. And don't think you're just going to fix it all in post, right? You're not going to fix it all in post. The more pre-planning you do, the smoother production and post-production will go. And it's the same thing for Kickstarter. And then I think you also, it's easy to get swept up in like the, I will just keep throwing bonuses in here to get the money to go up. Mm-hmm. And so just be a little bit more mindful of how much work goes with each bonus, because, you know, when you break it down hourly, it might not be that much money you're earning, right? Mm-hmm. So like my first one, I think it crossed like $25,000 for Reclaim Your Author Career. And that was great. And I had a lot of people come out of the woodwork because of that number. And a lot, you know, there was envy, there was weirdness around that number being so public. Mm-hmm. And I just kept saying, I don't think you understand how much work I have to do now. Right. It's $25,000 worth of work that I have to do for the next 4 months. You know, like this is a lot. So I think you can easily get swept away in trying to get that number up and forget like how much work you're adding on. Right. I would say, if you can get as much done ahead of time, like as much, if you're launching books, get the books written ahead of time. If you can front the costs of that and, you know, sit on those for a little while, get your materials done early. And then you can just focus on running the Kickstarter. Now, that being said, I have never successfully done that. I've had the best laid plans. But yeah, I think that the more you can get done ahead of time, the better. And just, you know, it's a platform where you can, the expectation is like, you can deliver like 2 months after the Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So you can give yourself as much time as you need. So it's better to overshoot. So you're like, you're over delivering when you give it to them early and you're saying, look, it's a month early. People are much happier with that than being like, hey guys, remember last year when I ran this Kickstarter, you know? So, overestimate how much time you need to fulfill. And yeah, I would say that it's really for my fiction Kickstarter, I think it made like 7,300 or something like that. For a series that no one had ever seen, in sci-fi comedy. I'd never written that under that pen name. And so I thought I thought that was great. I was happy with that because it covered most of the costs for producing three books, which obviously I could have done it cheaper, but
yeah,
I guess I'm a little bougie with my book production. So that was just nice to kind of start with that. But I think that beyond the money, thinking of Kickstarter as a buy-in tool, you're getting people to buy into whatever idea you're coming up with. Wow. I had ready-made fans built in with my space adventures, Alice Lick space adventures, because I had custom art. I had bookmarks. I had all this stuff to send them. So they're not just getting a book. They're getting, you know, fan swag. And now they're a fan, right? So I think that thinking of it as that sort of promotional tool is also really useful beyond just, yes, I'm getting some of the initial costs paid. I'm getting paid a higher royalty per book than on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all of that. And then lastly, I would say, however much you think you are talking too much about it, there will always be people in your audience who are like, you're doing what? I haven't heard about this.
Like 2 months later.
Yeah.
Right. Why didn't you tell me about this? I told you every day for a month. So there's really, you know, if it feels like you're doing too much, there's still people out there who haven't heard about it. So you can just keep talking about it. It's going to be uncomfortable. Right. It's definitely a stretch for me to talk about it all of the time. But I've, especially with this one, Sustain Your Author Career, I'm like, I just want everyone to read this freaking book so that we can all have a little bit of a break, you know? So, you know, that sort of sense of like, no, I've created something and I want to get it into your hands, like just back at the $10 level and I'll leave you alone. So I think that refocusing my attention there rather than like, oh, Claire, this is so embarrassing. You're having to talk about it. Look at you going on all these podcasts. This is, you're so thirsty for, for readers.
But every podcast has a different audience. So it's totally fine. And there will be people who have not heard until the very end. And they'll be like, oh, I'm so glad I found out about this before it closed.
Exactly.
And I think that's really a mind shift that helps authors is like, it's not, you're not begging people. You're not tricking them into getting something that they won't like. You're literally just telling the right people, hey, you know, that thing that you've been searching for, that's so hard to find because the world is cluttered and distracting. Here it is right here. Take it.
Yeah, I love the idea of thinking about Kickstarter as like almost an advertising marketing tool, because we do use it, you know, to help our fans get more of what we have to offer, kind of special things. But it is also getting the word out to people who've never heard of us. So, yeah, I was also wanted to ask you, what do you think was harder, the prep leading up to it or the fulfillment? Because nobody really talks about the fulfillment, but I think there's quite a few challenges in fulfillment.
Yeah, there is a huge motivational challenge inherent to fulfillment, and that you've already been paid. And so that's why I think that the motivation ahead of the Kickstarter is going to be just a little bit more fueling, because you haven't been paid yet, right? And so there's a little bit of that incentivizing of like, ooh, I can do this now. So that's why like the fulfillment, if your fulfillment is just like checking off who needs what and shipping it to them, that's not so bad. But if you haven't created a bunch of stuff and then you're like creating it afterward, the motivation, it just feels like you're wearing.
Especially if you know those people are waiting. It makes the weight heavier somehow.
And so, yeah, it's, that's why I say like really front load it. You're going to be doing yourself a whole lot of favors if you put a lot of the work at the front. And a lot of the creation, because you're going to have sort of that excitement that helps drive you on, rather than the like, oh, been paid and now I got to do this. And like, okay, like, you know, maybe you didn't get as many backers as you had hoped for. So that's, that can be kind of demoralizing if you let it, maybe you didn't get as much money as you'd hoped for, right? Maybe you just barely broke your goal and you're like, oh, now I got to do all this for just this little amount of money. Right. So there's, yes, the fulfillment can be really grueling. I would say that my fulfillment for, especially if you have like 20 things that you need to create, right? Because you're like, oh, I did one. Okay, well, cross that off the list. On to this next thing. I did that with my first one. I did less of it with my second one. I pretty much had everything but the third book ready for my fiction Kickstarter. And so, but yes, finishing that third book was difficult. And the first two were easier for, I mean, not just because of the excitement up front, but just what I had going on in life. And so it was just a matter of kind of shipping things after that one. And that was much, much easier than my first Kickstarter where I had to create video series. I had
to... You were crocheting sweaters or something crazy. No, I'm kidding.
I was like, did I? Because that sounds like something I would have done.
You're going, wait a minute.
Okay, three backers need a sweater.
Yeah, exactly. You need
mittens. Yeah. Yes. And then also, like, as much digital as you can do, as much digital as you can get away with. Goodness gracious.
Sarah learned that from you.
Yes.
Watching you do it the first time, she was like, wow, there is a lot of, you know, Sarah, Claire's doing a lot on the back end of as far as fulfillment. I'm going to do as much digital as I can. And I think she really.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you did help people.
Oh, I'm so glad that I could be the bad example. Yeah. I mean, this time the only physical thing I'm fulfilling is the book on this one. Good. You know, like paperback or a signed copy. Right. And then, yeah, like the in-person event, but
yeah,
that's easy enough. That's a whole other project that I could worry about in August.
Yeah. Long time from now. Well,
that's for future Claire.
Right. Future Claire. I mean, future Jamie really hates past Jamie a lot of the time.
Yeah. Well, the good thing about future Claire is she's going to be firing on all cylinders all of the time. Just an absolute peak performance. At least that's what I am hoping.
That's what you envision.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's been great having you here. If you were starting over today, what would you do anything different?
With my fiction, I would make sure that it wasn't, that I didn't have any financial need for its success immediately. I would make sure that I was getting other income.
Yeah.
And I would just think more long-term and, you know, make sure that I'm enjoying the process. I think I would prioritize that, over everything else. Because there's, I mean, when I got in, there was such a promise. I mean, people had dollar signs in their eyes every time they talked about rapid release, and that those times are gone. We've got to let it go. So yeah, if I were starting today, that's what I would do. And that's basically what I'm doing now is just making sure that, you know, thankfully I have the backlist where I can kind of, you know, mess around some days and not have to worry about it. But, yeah, that pace is the only sustainable one.
Good. That's great answer.
Well, tell everybody where they can find you and Sustain Your Author Career book.
So if you go to kickffs.com, that is my Kickstarter. And if it's over by the time you listen to this episode, it is, there'll be a pre-order link, or if it's available, there'll be an order link. And then you can find all of my services at ffs.media. Or if you're interested in more of the Liberated Writer stuff, you can just go to liberatedwriter.com, and that has the course and the retreat. So
fantastic.
Yep. It was awesome having you.
Thanks so much for having me back. I love chatting with y'all.
Yeah. Thanks for coming. It was good. So we'll have all those links at wishidknownthenforwriters.com, and you can find the link there, the links to the website and the Kickstarter. And then if you want to support the podcast, you can go to that same link/support. So we will see everybody next week. Bye. Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Wish I'd Known Then podcast. We hope this episode inspired you, empowered you, and made you laugh a little bit too. If you loved it, tell your friends about it. And if you feel so inclined, leave us a review. We look forward to being with you again next week.